Thank you for your kind introduction. I want to tell you about the worst day of my life, since this is a lecture on happiness. Start with the opposite extreme. So I got this dream job in Washington, D.C. It was director of the honors program. And I was so excited. I moved my family across the country and started up this new position. It was about a 40% raise over what I was making before. And when I got there, it was actually much better than I thought it would be. So I made all these friends, and I was in this wonderful parish, and things were really, really great. But there was one huge problem, namely that my wife hated it in Washington, D.C. She absolutely hated it. So I thought to myself, well, I will change this situation. So I thought, well, I'm going to start praying. And I'm going to pray that God somehow changes her mind and her heart, that she really starts to love living in Washington. So that's what I started to do. So I praying. Nothing changed at all, right? Nothing got better at all. So eventually, about a month or two later, I came to my wife and I said, well, honey, I've been really praying for you that you're going to love Washington and stay here in D.C. And, you know, I just want to let you know I've been praying every day for that. And she said, well, that's very interesting. So have you asked God what God wants? And I thought, oh, Lord, no, I haven't done that. So finally, I thought, well, I don't want to ask God what God wants, because what if God wants me to go back to Los Angeles? That's the last thing I want. So I was afraid to pray. And then after maybe 3 weeks, I thought, well, you know, God is all-knowing and all-loving, and well, maybe I should, like, check in with God just to see, and maybe, you know. Anyway, so I prayed about it, and I pretty much came to conviction right away that I family ought to move back to Los Angeles. So I moved back to Los Angeles. And I'd like to tell you that when I got back to Los Angeles, I was a happy camper, and everything was going great. But that would be a lie. I was not a happy camper at all. I was quite miserable and sad, and missing my friends, and missing lots of things from D.C. But what happened is I do what every scholar would do if you have a serious question. I went to Google. Googled in how to be happier. Looked through the results. And one of the things I discovered was this whole new field of psychology. And it's called positive psychology. It was started by a guy named Martin Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania. And Seligman's idea was that psychologists should not only study that part of the human condition that's depression and anxiety and things like that, that psychology should also focus at least some attention on the opposite extreme. So for instance, resiliency. What gives people hope? How is it that some people go through unbelievably difficult circumstances and come out on the other side stronger? So not post-traumatic stress, but post-traumatic growth. And so Seligman and his team of researchers wanted to investigate this in an empirical way. So when they introduce new medications, what they'll do is they'll give it to two groups, and neither group will know which one's getting the real medication and which one's getting the placebo, just sugar pills or whatever. And they'll study and they'll see, you know, which, you know, group has the effects. So Seligman thought, we're going to study various alleged paths to happiness and practices of happiness in the same sort of way. So about 20 years ago, this whole new field of positive psychology came into existence. So when I was going through my difficulties, I thought, I'm going to check this out. This field of study defines happiness. So happiness has been defined by lots of people in different ways, but I want to present to you one way of thinking about happiness. Now, maybe it's not right, but we can think about it together at least. And it's from Seligman. He defines happiness in terms of five characteristics: positive emotion, engagement, relationship, meaning, and achievement, PERMA. So first, positive emotion, that's pretty self-explanatory, right? Sometimes you have exuberance and joy and you feel upbeat and you feel great. So that's positive emotion. But some people, Seligman thinks, mistakenly define happiness simply and solely in this purely subjective way, as if happiness is just positive emotion, there's nothing more to it. Seligman disagrees. He thinks there is more to happiness than just positive emotion. In addition to that, there's engagement. Now, what's engagement? Engagement is sometimes called flow. The idea of engagement or flow is what you maybe experience when you're doing some activity for maybe 2 or 3 hours, and for you, it feels like it's maybe 15 minutes. right? And so maybe for one person it's doing jujitsu, for somebody else it's doing chess, somebody else is talking with a friend, but I'm sure we all have things that we do, and we're doing it for, you know, a while, and it feels like time stops. We have total engagement in the moment. So that's flow or engagement. Third is meaning. Now what is meaning? Seligman defines this in an objective sense. Meaning is making the world somehow through your existence and your activities a better place. So you can be very high in terms of meaning, and yet very low in terms of positive emotion. So think of someone like Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, as you may know, famously had his bouts with depression. He had dark moods. Abraham Lincoln's similar, right? He had a wife who suffered from mental illness and made his life extremely, extremely difficult. And then he himself suffered from depression. But both of those men, Lincoln and Churchill, excelled in terms of meaning, right? Lincoln obviously saving the Union, Churchill saving the entire world from the menace of Nazism, and then doing his part to save the world from the menace of communism after that. So meaning is making the world a better place. It doesn't have to be something so grand as being a Churchill or a Lincoln. Any good mother, any good father can have meaning in his or her life simply by being a good mother or a good father, right? Helping their kids do their homework, making sure there's enough food in the house, doing everyday work. Really any work can be a way of finding meaning, right? I mentioned this earlier where there's a discussion with some people before this talk began about the value of work. And all work has this kind of inherent value. It can be very meaningful. You can think of work as love made visible. All legitimate work, right, is love made visible. So meaning is making the world a better place in some way through your work. So then after meaning, relationship. Relationship is really the key of happiness according to positive psychology. The most famous study of happiness ever was probably the Grant study at Harvard University. And what it did is it took undergraduates, many people your age, and followed them all the way through the course of their life, you know, starting with 18 all the way, and some of these people died in their 90s. And every year they interviewed them and do physiological tests, and they looked for what made for a good life. And the lead researcher of the Grant study, when the whole thing was completed, was asked, well, what did you find? And his answer was, happiness is love, full stop. That those people who had love in their lives had meaningful friendships, loving families, made a difference in terms of their loving relationships, those people had really good lives. And other people, even if they made tons of money, even if they were very powerful, even if they had whatever, their lives ended up being quite miserable. And we know now a lot more than they did even then about how money and happiness relate to one another. So it is true that money can make you a lot more happy if you, for instance, don't eat three meals a day, right? If you're hungry and you don't have dinner on a regular basis, more money will make you a lot more happy. Where, let's say at night you're cold, you don't have, you know, warm clothes, well, more money would make you more happy. But basically what they found is after you break through that, you have enough food to eat, you have clothes in your bag, you've got a place to sleep, that more money makes almost no difference to happiness. It just doesn't make any difference whether you're making, for instance, whether you're making $30,000 a year, $100,000 a year, or $300,000 a year. In fact, people at all income levels, when asked, how much more money would you need to be comfortable? People at all income levels say the same thing. Well, if I just had about 10 or 15% more, well, then I'd be comfortable. And that's true of people making $300,000 a year. The fact is, we get used to whatever level of material success that we have, right? Like, for instance, all of you are in the top 1%. If you look at the world population there, you won't have any chance to go to college. About 1%. Almost all Americans are in the top 1%. If you make more than $30,000 a year worldwide, you're in the top 1% now. For most of human history, 99% of people were extremely poor. And what I mean by extremely poor, making less than $2 a day. Right? So try surviving on $2 a day. I mean, it's, you know, You're starving, you're freezing, you're cold, it's miserable. So we are way more wealthy now. There's an interesting chart. If I had a chart here, it shows the average wealth of Americans from about 1950 to today. And basically, if you look at the chart, it basically goes like this. More and more and more and more and more. So the average American now has a cell phone, has a color TV, car, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Families live in bigger houses. So as a society, the United States, people in the United States are way, way, way more wealthy than they were, you know, 50 years ago. But then if you look at the percentage of people that report that they're very happy, here's what that line looks like. Basically a flat line. All the money that we have now has made no appreciable difference for the percentage of people that report being very happy. So what does make a difference? Close relationships. They don't have to be romantic relationships necessarily, but close, loving relationships. Friends, family, etc. And then achievement, the A. What is achievement? Achievement is about setting your goals and trying to reach your goals. Right? How many of you have a to-do list? Okay. Well, how do you feel when you go through your to-do list for a day and you check off every single one? Yeah, it feels good at the end of the day, right? You're like, yeah, got it all done, right? We are beings that like to achieve goals. And if we're hitting our goals, we're getting our telos, as Aristotle would say, we feel a sense of accomplishment and a sense of happiness. So what Seligman thinks is this, that for us to be happy, we need more than just positive emotion. It's not enough just to feel good. You could take a drug and feel good for a while. That's not enough, he thinks, for real happiness. You need all of those characteristics. You do need positive emotion, that's part of it. You need engagement, you need relationships, you need meaning, and you need achievement. All of these things are part of happiness. And how do you get more happiness? Well, here's an interesting study that Seligman did. He took his college students, and to the first group, he said, I want you to go and have fun, okay? So go out to the movies, go eat ice cream, do something like that, and come back to me and report about your positive emotion. And then he talked to the second group of college students. He said, I want you to go serve other people. Do something to make the world a better place. Go to an old folks' home and hang out with them and try to cheer them up. Go volunteer, teach the kids how to read or something like that. And so both groups went out and did their thing. And when they came back, both groups reported that they had positive emotion, an increase in positive emotion. People that ate ice cream and went to the movies, people that did service. But the people who ate ice cream reported that the positive emotion left very quickly. Yes, when I went to the movies and got ice cream, I felt, you know, positive emotion. But then, basically after I ate the ice cream, it was gone and that was the end of it. The people who went out and served others, they had an increase in positive emotion that lasted more than a week. And so Seligman found people that serve others increase their positive emotion in a more lasting way than people that just do fun, you know, eating ice cream kinds of things. And I thought to myself, well, this is interesting because, you know, as a Christian, I've heard many times about the value of loving and serving and helping others. And here's a way in which the secular psychology is vindicating something that I was taught as a child, that this is a good idea. Try to love, serve your neighbor, help your neighbor in need. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was naked and you clothed me. Okay, wow, this is really kind of an interesting overlap. Another thing Seligman found is that forgiveness was one of the most important things that we can do to be more happy. Now, why is forgiveness so important? Well, forgiveness is so important because every human relationship is going to have its strengths. If I ask you about how you relate to your mother, you know, is it true? Do you always get along with your mother?
Not always.
Not always? Yeah, well, that's a surprise. I mean, no one here, I think, could say, yes, I always get along with my mother. I always get along with my father and my siblings and my friends. We never fight. Of course not. Human fighting and disagreeing has started way back in the Garden of Eden, right? Adam and Eve get in a big fight. Adam blames Eve for the fall, blah, blah, blah. This is really one of the oldest stories ever told. So if we are human, we're going to have these conflicts. And if we have these conflicts, what's going to happen is you're going to get mad at me and I'm going to get mad at you. And if I don't have forgiveness, you know what I say? You're out of my life. I get on my phone, I delete you. I block you, whatever. We don't talk, that's the end of it, right? And then I move on and make a new friend, right? But we get in a fight too late. At some point, I'm going to say something to you, you're going to say something to me, and then you block me off, and that's it. You can go through your whole family, you can go through all your friends, you can go through everybody, and you can be entirely alone or with people you just met last week unless you have forgiveness. We literally can't have any long-term relationships that are deep unless we have forgiveness. It's absolutely essential. This is the secular psychologist telling us this. And I thought, again, wow, that's really weird. I mean, how? It's just weird. I mean, I've learned my whole life about the importance of forgiveness. If you think about the teachings of Jesus, few of the teachings of Jesus are more crystal clear than the importance of forgiveness. He was asked by his apostles, how many times do we need to forgive? 7 times? Now, the standard Jewish teaching at the time was you need to forgive people 3 times. So this is more than double, right? 7 times, Lord? Is that? That's a lot. And his answer was, no, you need to forgive them 70 times 7. And you might be a math major and know, 140 times? So the 141st time, I could just not forgive them anymore? Well, no, that's a symbolic way of saying perfectly. 7 is the biblical symbol of perfection. So 70 times 7 means absolutely perfectly. Jesus even says, if someone were to do wrong to you 7 times in one day you should forgive that person. And Jesus wasn't someone who merely preached about forgiveness. Jesus was someone who practiced forgiveness. You may recall, as Jesus was dying on the cross, one of the last things he said was what? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So Jesus preached and practiced forgiveness. Why? Well, I think it's absolutely essential for our happiness. Unforgiveness is like carrying around a bunch of burning hot coals. And you did something wrong to me at dinner. I'm so mad at you. What a jerk. I can't believe what he said to me. I can't stand that guy. He's so bad. I can't stand him. And so I'm seething with anger. I've got these burning hot coals. And I'm just waiting. I'm going to throw this in your face. I hurt you so bad. I'm getting ready to throw this burning hot coal in his face. But you know, who's getting burned by these burning hot coals all the time? I am. He may not even know that I'm angry with him, but I'm walking around carrying this inside of me. So forgiveness, they've actually done studies on this. Unforgiveness physically harms you. Physically harms you. You're more likely to die young if you're carrying around a bunch of unforgiveness. So I was surprised by this in the psychology literature. I thought, well, that's really weird. Okay, well, I guess forgiveness is good. And then I kept reading in the secular psychology literature. You know what else I found? That people who go to church are much less likely to kill themselves than people that don't go to church. There was a recent story in the LA Times that talked about suicide rates going up. And then in the story it said there was one group that not only did the suicide rate not go up, there was one group in this large study that had no cases of suicide. Zero. 5,000 people, no cases of suicide. And that was Catholic women who went to church more than once a week. Zero cases of suicide. I thought, wow, that's really something. Now, why would that be? Well, maybe part of the reason that would be is that another thing that the secular psychologists found was the importance of gratitude. So what do I mean by gratitude? Seligman recommends, and this might be helpful for you, a little practice you can do. It's free, it's easy, and it will make you more happy. At the end of today, just think about your day. And think about any 3 things that went well for you today. Things that you're grateful for. So it could be a very little thing. Like, for instance, I had Panda Express for dinner tonight. Somebody else bought it. It's not a huge thing, but it was good. And I'm grateful to people that bought me the Panda Express. So that was a small thing. I can say I'm grateful for that. Grateful for meeting some new people that seem really nice. Have a good conversation with them. Be grateful for that. Grateful for having a safe trip up here. Didn't get in a car accident. So it doesn't have to be grateful for winning the lottery or some huge thing. It can be very small things. What Seligman found is people who write this down, just 3 sentences a day, even if they were moderately depressed, 91% of those people reported feeling better as a result of doing this. Now what's the reason for that? The reason is that if you practice gratitude, what you do is you train your mind to look for the good things that are already in your life. The fact is, all of our lives have a combination of light and darkness. No one's life, I'm assuming here, is pure light, nothing but good, everything's perfect in your life. No one here, I'm assuming, has a life that's pure hell, nothing but terrible stuff in your life. All of our lives are this kind of mix. But the thing is, we have a default towards what's negative. We have a bias towards the darkness, you might say. It draws our attention. And you can see why if you think in evolutionary terms. If you think back, and we're some ancient tribe, 5,000 years ago, if I fail to notice the cougar in the brush, and the cougar ate me, well, I'm in big, huge trouble, right? Whereas if I fail to notice the fruit that's hanging on the tree, well, okay, I'm probably going to survive just missing that one fruit. So we have to be hyper, or did have to in the ancient world, be hyper aware of threats and evil and danger so as not to get eaten by the lion. And so we still have that. We still have this bias, this negativity bias is what the psychologists call it, where we are hyper-focused on what's bad and draws our attention. But we can train ourselves, we can train our minds to focus on what's good. I mean, if you were to keep track during the day, how many black shoes do I see each day? You really made an effort to write down at the end of the day how many times you saw black shoes. Well, if you did that, you'd be looking around at shoes more. You'd be aware, okay, well, what color shoes do they have? Right, it'd be on your mind more. So what the gratitude exercises do is train us to notice and appreciate the good things that are actually already in our lives. It doesn't mean the bad goes away, but it means we notice the good things more. They're highlighted in our minds. We're more on the lookout for these good things. In fact, when something good happens to you, you may even think to yourself, wow, I wonder if this would be my top three today. So gratitude is something that is, according to secular psychology, extremely beneficial for us to practice. Now, does gratitude play any role in, say, Catholic spirituality? Well, if you know of someone named St. Ignatius Loyola, he recommended to all the people that came to him for spiritual direction that they do something which he called the examine. And the beginning of the examine is to think about the last 24 hours and recall whatever gifts God has given you in that period. I mean, it's almost an exact replication of what Seligman recommended to the depressed people. And in the Catholic tradition, you may know, we have this practice called the Eucharist. And what is the Eucharist? Well, the Eucharist is just the Greek term for Thanksgiving. In the United States, at least, suicides fall to their lowest on Thanksgiving Day. You can track them all through the year, but the very fewest number of suicides in the country are on Thanksgiving Day. Why is that? Well, I think it's pretty obvious. On Thanksgiving Day, more people than ever are practicing gratitude. They're focused on what they have rather on what they don't have. And for Catholics, we're extremely lucky because we can have Thanksgiving Day not just once a year in November, but every Sunday, and even more often if we want. So gratitude is very important. So basically, as you can kind of see, in my reading of positive psychology, I saw all these overlaps, all these ways in which positive psychology and Christian practice overlapped. And in all my reading, I've never found anything, any way in which the recommendations of positive psychology for happiness contradict anything in Christian practice. Now you might say, okay, fine, that's fine. Well, why not just have positive psychology then? You'll get all these good benefits and you'll be more happy and et cetera, et cetera. And what, if anything, does Christianity bring that you couldn't find in positive psychology? Well, as good as positive psychology is, I think there are things that Christianity brings that are distinctive and that can't be found in psychology. I think psychological happiness alone is not enough. What are those things? Well, for one thing, all of us are faced with death. Everyone you love is going to die. You know you're going to die. And death is the end of perma. Positive emotion, engagement, relationship, meaning, achievement, it's all gone. It's all taken away by death. And secular psychology really has no answer for death. It has no resources for overcoming death, for moving beyond death. Of course, the Christian tradition does, right? We have the hope of the resurrection. A second thing that Christianity gives that positive psychology can't has to do with wrongdoing. All people, I think, whether you're an atheist, a Jew, a Hindu, Buddhist, whatever your religious view, all people do things that they know are wrong. I don't think any honest person can look in the mirror and say, I am perfect. I've never done anything wrong to anybody. I'm just absolutely perfect. And that person, if that person exists, actually would be doing something wrong, namely having the sin of pride and a radical lack of self-knowledge. So, everyone does wrong. Now, psychology can help take away feelings of guilt, right? Just like if you got a shot of Novocaine, it takes away the feeling of your tooth hurting and the tooth being infected. But positive psychology doesn't have any remedy for the actual guilt, for the actual separation that exists when someone does wrong. It can take away the feelings of guilt, maybe, but just as using Novocaine doesn't get rid of the tooth infection, but just leaves the infection masked, so too, psychology can take away feelings of guilt, but it doesn't do anything about the actual guilt, the actual wrongdoing, the actual sin. But again, Christianity has an answer for that. That's the Christian message, that God does take care of our sin. That's why in the Catholic Church is a sacrament called confession, where when we make garbage, we can have the garbage taken out and thrown away. A third thing that Christianity brings that can be found in psychology is God. So positive psychology is neutral with respect to God's existence. There are some people that are atheistic but are positive psychologists, like Jonathan Haidt. There are some people that are agnostic that are positive psychologists, like Mark Seligman. There are some people that are Christian that are positive psychologists, like Robert Emmons. So positive psychology isn't committed for or against theism or Christianity. It's neutral with respect to that. You have all kinds of people. But precisely because it's neutral, it doesn't focus on cultivating a relationship with God. It can and does show that those people who practice their faith are, on average, much more happy than those people that don't. But it doesn't give us resources for deepening our relationship with God. But that's precisely the goal of Christianity, to establish, deepen, and nourish our love of God and our love of neighbor. That's what the sacraments are for. That's what the stories of the scripture are for. That's what the death, resurrection of Christ is all about, is to unite us again with God so that we can love God and love our neighbor the way Jesus would. So, if Christianity gives us all the things that positive psychology would give us, and if Christianity even gives us more than that, well, there's a big problem that remains, a very big problem. And the problem is this, and I'll just ask you, please raise your hand if you know someone who is Christian who is grumpy and unhappy. Please raise your hand. You ever met a Christian who's grumpy and unhappy? It looks like all the hands are raised. So if everything I said was true, how do you explain grumpy, unhappy Christians? Because it is true. There are some grumpy and unhappy Christians. True enough. I think one thing to take into account in terms of explaining this is the fact that people have a different genetic basis for happiness. Just as some people are just born with a native basis for being more athletic than others, like for instance, Michael Jordan, I can't help but think that he was just born being a better athlete than I am. Right? LeBron James, I just can't help but think he's born with natural gifts for basketball that I lack. Right? Obviously, I'm as tall as he is, I'm as strong as he is. Obviously, he has natural gifts I don't have. Now, he developed them too, but he started off ahead. But the same thing's true with happiness, and you guys have probably seen this yourselves. You may know children. Think of little kids, two or three, barely, you know, walking. And some of them are very upbeat. They're Mr. Sunshine, they're Miss Sunshine. Smiley, happy, everything's great, very cheerful. And then you probably have seen some kids, two, three, little kids, grumpy, Mr. Rain, Mrs. Rain, sad, you know, downbeat. We're born to a great degree with our personality. Some people just by nature are more outgoing, enthusiastic, cheerful, whatever. Some people are less. So you could have some Christians that are born, you might say, genetically with a genetic predisposition that's going to be more dour. And that's just the way they were born. If they weren't Christian, they'd be even more dour than they are now. But secondly, your religious beliefs, whether you're an atheist, agnostic, Christian, Jew, whatever, do not protect you, obviously, from physical harm. from physical diseases. A Christian as well as an atheist can get run over by a car. And if you get run over by a car, you're going to be less happy than you would have been if you weren't run over by the car. Because when your body is aching and bones are broken and whatever, it makes you sad. It makes you less happy than you'd be, right? And the same thing's true of mental illness. Your religious belief doesn't inoculate you against all mental illness. So you can have Christians that have physical problems that diminish their happiness, and that have psychological problems or mental health problems that diminish their happiness. And their religious belief doesn't inoculate them against those things. A third thing that diminishes the happiness of Christians is that many Christians don't practice what Jesus preached very well. They don't forgive their neighbor. They don't serve their neighbor. They're not practicing gratitude. They're not people that are praying and practicing their faith very well. They're in fact people that are doing the opposite of those things in many cases. So this would be a little bit like if you thought of Jesus as a doctor, and you go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you prescriptions. Hey, take these pills, you know, morning, noon, and night. Take this inhaler. Rub on this lotion on your rash or whatever. Thanks, doctor. I got these medications. I really appreciate it. A lot of good ideas. And you go home and get all these medications as a pharmacist, and you go home, and you put them behind your mirror, and you don't get them out. You don't take the pills morning, noon, and night. You don't use the inhaler. You don't rub on the cream on your rash, and you don't get better. And then you say, well, what a dumb doctor. That was a terrible doctor. I'm not getting better at all. Well, yeah, you didn't take the medication, right? If the divine physician says to be grateful and you don't practice that, well, of course you're not getting better. If you're supposed to forgive other people, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us, and instead you harbor grudges and you still remember the kid in fourth grade that threw the Coke in your face and you're still mad at him, well, yes, of course you're not happy, right? If you don't practice love and you just waste time doing whatever things that aren't loving to others, well, yeah, you're going to be unhappy. So part of what makes some Christians less happy than they would be is not carrying out these good ideas, these good prescriptions, you might say, not using the medication. All right. Now, I don't know all of you, but I do know some of you a little bit. And I think the people that I've gotten to meet here are good people. And I assume you may think of yourself as a good person. Now, if you're a good person, you probably don't fail to do these sorts of things like gratitude and forgiveness and serving others and forgive and all those things. You probably don't do that deliberately. Thomas Aquinas famously said there are three causes for sin. One is ignorance. So some people do things that are sinful and wrong and against love just because they don't know better. Another one is malice. So his idea was sometimes people act against love and against their own happiness because they're filled with malice. They're like, to hell with you, God. Evil be thou my good. I'm going to do this. I don't care what you say. Okay? And then the third is what he called weakness of will. And the weakness of will is basically where you have good intentions and you really want to do the right thing. And then you get in the situation, you get in the moment, one thing leads to another, before you know, oh, geez, and then all of a sudden you're doing the wrong thing, right? Weakness of will. You come in with good intentions, and you end up falling away, not having good intentions, and doing the wrong thing. Now, I'm guessing, for some of you at least, you are not people that are ignorant of wrongdoing. I'm guessing for many of you, when you do something wrong, you're not like, I had no idea stealing was wrong. I had no idea saying rude things to people was wrong. Oh, thanks for telling me. I won't do it again. I mean, probably not for most of you, right? You know when you do things that are wrong. You're not ignorant. And then I think for most people here, probably, you're not full of malice. You're not like, I don't care about doing evil. I just want to be as evil as possible. I doubt you're saying that to yourself probably most of the time. So probably for most people, the cause of our wrongdoing is weakness of will. So what I want to do in the conclusion of this lecture is talk about remedies for weakness of will. In other words, ways in which we can grow stronger in our willpower. So let me talk, first of all, about what the secular psychologists have found. The first is they found that exercising willpower develops willpower. Willpower, you might say, is a little bit like a muscle. If you want to be stronger physically, what should you do? You should go to the gym, lift weights, use resistance. And when you lift weights and use resistance, you'll get stronger and stronger. Or maybe you go running, right? You run, and the more miles you run, the faster you run, you get better and better at running. So if we want more willpower, the secular psychologist suggests we should exercise more willpower. So, in the Christian tradition, this is called mortification. The idea is to do something a little bit against the grain. And I'm not talking about something crazy like, you know, sit on top of a pillar for 30 years or something, or, you know, just eat bread and water for 2 months straight. But I'm talking about small things that no one would even notice. For instance, think about probably eat 3 meals a day. At every meal, you could exercise some self-control. You can develop some willpower. How? Well, you could, for example, not put salt on your food. Maybe you like to put salt in your fries, you can say, oh, I'm not going to put salt in my fries. Or maybe you could eat the part of your food you like the least. So for me, if I get a steak, potatoes, and vegetables, I like steak the most, potatoes second, vegetables third. So I can start the meal by eating the vegetables. Again, not a big, huge thing. But the idea is that if every day you do something that kind of develops your willpower, every day you do a few push-ups, a few sit-ups, you jog a little bit, well, the more you do that, the stronger you're going to get. Your willpower is strengthened when you use it, just like your muscles are strengthened when you use them. The second thing that the psychologists recommend for developing willpower is to remember the fact that no temptation lasts forever. When you're tempted to do something wrong, it feels in the moment as if it's like a wave, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and I better just give in, because look at this wave. It's 20 feet high, and I'm helpless. I'm just going to give in, right? But the fact is, temptations of their very nature can't last forever, and never do last forever. Here's one way to think about it. I'm sure you've had the experience of trying to focus on one thing, like you're studying, right? You've got finals coming up. You got this big final day after tomorrow, whatever, and you're trying to study. And you're like sitting there and like, I gotta learn my physics. I'm gonna do it. And you're focusing. And then before you know it, for me at least, all of a sudden you're thinking about the weekend and who's playing football and what's going on. I've got lunch coming up. And all of a sudden you're distracted, right? If you're a person who prays, I'm sure you've had the experience that I have. You sit down to pray. All right, Lord, here I am. I'm gonna make time for you. I'm gonna pray. And then within 30 seconds, all of a sudden I'm thinking about whatever and Notre Dame football and I'm just off. So the fact is, our minds are naturally restless, right? Even if we try our best to focus only on one thing, you can't. You really can't. Your mind is going to wander away. Now, that's a bad thing if you're trying to study, right? Because your mind wanders away. Or if you're trying to pray, your mind wanders away. But it's a good thing in times of temptation. You can always tell yourself the truth. This temptation is not going to last forever. If you don't give in, this temptation is going to move off the stage of your mind, and before you know it, you'll be thinking about Notre Dame football or whatever you think about. I don't know what you think about, but Notre Dame football is something I think about, obviously. One last recommendation for developing more willpower. That's the idea of, well, let's drop a little thought experiment. I want all of you now to, you can think about anything you want. I want you, though, not to think about white bears. Okay? Don't think about white bears at all. Okay? Go ahead. Don't think about big white bears or small white bears or white bears eating other bears. Don't think about any bears. No white bears. Okay? Go ahead. How are you doing so far?
Not too well.
Not too well. Exactly. So, imagine a temptation like a white bear. Right? And the white bear moves onto the campground. Now, you probably know if you've ever done camping, what they recommend is don't feed the bear. Why? Because they know if you feed the bear, what happens? The bear goes away, gets the bear family, and then you got mama bear, dad bear, kid bear, uncle bear, you got everybody, you got five bears there, right? And if you feed those five bears, what happens then? They go back and get the nephews, and they got, now you got a family reunion, you got every bear in the county right at your campsite. So feeding the bear does not work. So don't feed the bear. When you're tempted and give in, that's feeding the bear. And they're going to bring their uncle and their cousin, and then it's going to be a whole family there, bears there. It's going to be worse and worse for you. On the other hand, another thing you don't want to do is fight the bear. If the bear comes in your campsite, you go out there with a baseball bat and hit him over the head. That's a really bad idea. Right? Don't fight the bear either. Right? And that's what that's what that experiment about don't think about barriers was meant to show. If you're tempted to do something that you know you shouldn't do, and you think, I'm not going to do this, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, and you're just thinking about it nonstop, and you're trying not, I'm not going to think about that, what? It's called the ironic rebound effect. Right? If you're trying not to think about white bears, then you have to monitor your mind and think, am I thinking about white bears yet? Am I thinking about white bears yet? Oh crap, I'm thinking about white bears now. And he comes back and, you know? So, you don't fight the bear either. You don't want to hit in the nose. Try to get rid of it that way. So what should you do if a bear wanders under your campground? Just ignore it. The bear is going to wander away. If you don't feed it, it's going to sniff around, look around, whatever, and then the bear is going to wander away because it's pretty boring. Right? So don't get in. That's going to bring all kinds of bears in your life. Don't punch it in the face and say, I'm not going to think about it, I'm not going to think about it, because you're going to think about it. It's an ironic rebound effect. Just ignore it. It's going to go away. It's going to leave on its own. It'll sniff around the campground a while. And then it's going to get bored. You'll get bored. And they'll all go away. So, positive psychology and faith. A surprising connection. I should underscore that these findings were found and empirically verified. None of this is faith-based. All this stuff about positive psychology, doing gratitude, forgiveness, none of that is faith-based. This is all empirically grounded and tested. Now, can I say to you that my life is perfect now? That everything is wonderful in my life? I can't say that. Because the fact is, we'll never have heaven on earth. We won't. It doesn't matter how good things go for you. You're never going to have heaven on earth. Why? Because what is heaven? Well, at least Aquinas thought heaven is the perfection of love and knowledge. And the fact is, here below, we can't have perfect love and knowledge of God or of ourselves or of other people. So the fact is, here below, our friendship with God, with ourselves, and with other people is always going to be tenuous. It's always going to be imperfect. And that's actually good news. Because one way to be a lot less happy than you otherwise would be is if you had too high expectations. If you thought, well, I am going to find heaven on earth. I just do the positive psychology stuff, do the religion stuff, everything's going to be great. Well, no, everything's not going to be great. It's not going to be perfect. We're not going to have heaven on earth. But we can shoot for something realistic. To love God more, to love our neighbor more, to be more grateful, to be more forgiving, to be more merciful to others, to be of greater service to others, and that way make ourselves and make many others have a better life than we would have had. Thank you.